My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me now and we will explore these topics and so much more with fascinating guests, authors, and experts who will guide us to Destination Unlimited. You care about the environment, the world you live in, and the world you're going to leave behind for future generations. Perhaps you already avoid wasting energy and buying more things than you need, reducing your ecological footprint. Yet there is a limit, given your family and circumstances. What can you do that will truly help heal our planet? My guest this week on Destination Unlimited, John Beamer, says we can do this with our environmental handprints. John Beamer has more than 40 years of experience creating sustainability, including repair cafes, free cycling, village building convergences, and ballot initiatives for outdoor schools and clean energy. John Beamer is a mechanical engineer and holds a certificate in process-oriented psychology. He has managed utility energy conservation programs and now provides organizational development consulting to nonprofits. His website is johnbeamer.com, and he joins me this week to share his work and his new book, Our Environmental Handprints, Recover the Land, Reverse Global Warming, Reclaim the Future. Please join me in welcoming to Destination Unlimited, John Beamer. Welcome, John.
Hello.
Thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your important work and your message. Please share with our listeners your early path and how it led to being an environmentalist.
I wouldn't say I was an environmentalist until I was like age 25 or so. But I did spend time in the outdoors hunting with my grandfather and that sort of thing. And I love to do rock climbing and that sort of thing. So I have a love of nature that comes from my childhood. And that's one of the points that I like to make is that, introducing kids to nature yields the possibility that they can become good stewards later on. And then around the age of 25, I was working in aerospace, and I was invited to a little talk on the problems with nuclear power. There's a ballot initiative about controlling nuclear waste and that sort of thing in California. And I remember that first flip chart. It said, plutonium is bad for people and other living things. And between that and a couple of the things that were happening with me at the time, I sort of had an awakening that I needed to change my career. And I went back to school, went from electrical engineering to mechanical engineering. And basically, my mission was to find alternatives to nuclear power. So I got into energy conservation and solar. So that was the big shift in my career at that point.
As you touched upon, one of the reasons I ask guests to share their path is so that listeners with children may share these concepts and inspire those children. What are some of the ways, in addition to introducing them to nature, to teach kids to become both environmentally aware and active?
The first thing I want to say is reading them stories. Two stories that are historically important are The Lorax by Dr. Seuss, a person that basically was the overseer of a place that had been logged, and the story of the man that planted trees by a Frenchman. Both of those stories have been very influential historically in influencing a whole lot of young people. Now, there's current environmental stories that are, you can go to the library and you can go to on the websites and that sort of thing. So reading them stories, environmental stories, is actually a really good thing. Oh, by the way, Bambi, the movie by Walt Disney, actually had a relatively profound awakening effect on our population. It just seemed like a kid's story, but it helped us care about animals in ways we didn't care about before. And then involving kids in whatever we do, you know, planting in the gardens. And my kids were with me when I did mailing parties for ballot initiatives and that sort of thing. So, you know, the more they're just around what's going on that's worthwhile, the more they're going to pick up on it and make that part of their lives.
And as the parents do, so do the children.
Yes and no. There are kids that go way beyond what the parents have done. And
also, we hope so.
And I also know of kids that have gotten environmental degrees, you know, that were their parents were activists.
Your book is entitled Our Environmental Handprints. Most are familiar with the term footprints, especially carbon footprints. What's the difference and what inspired handprint?
Well, let's start off with the idea of the footprint is the resources that it takes for us to live here on this planet. So we require a certain amount of energy, a certain amount of carbon, a certain amount of water. And Mathis Wackernagel wrote a really good book about that and came up with an accounting system for helping us quantify what those things were and then understanding the Earth has a limited capacity to provide those things. And so we really want to try to stay within that capacity. And we people in North America are not very good at staying within that. We use many times the amount of resources that would be our allocation if you thought in terms of the percentage of the Earth that we occupy. So that's all well and good. That's a way of thinking about things. The problem is I keep running into the limits of what I can do to just do less harm, to use less resources. My lifestyle, my commitments and all that tend to kind of corral me into kind of a certain kind of way of life. And yes, that can change, but I was looking for something where we can break out of that, a different kind of paradigm. And what I came up with was the handprint, the idea that we can be proactive and we can change things, change the way things are done, influence other people so that they are doing, you know, requiring less impact for their actions. And I came up with that idea about 2007 or so. And as I wrote about it and that sort of thing, I realized that I wasn't the only guy that had come up with this idea. The organization in India, Center for Environmental Education, also used the handprint as a symbol. So I didn't invent the idea, but it's like an idea that has, it's whose time has come. And I find that it's very good because we can go beyond whatever the cost for being here is. We can have a handprint that's greater than our footprint. And, you know, if we're good at it, many, many, many times greater than our footprint.
And the concept in my mind, as you're projecting it right now, is that the footprint is the impression we make without giving anything back. The handprint is the extension of the hand and giving back.
Mm-hmm.
Does that sort of resonate with what you're sharing?
Yes, it does. My chiropractor likes to say hands heal.
Yes, absolutely.
We can do things that are really healing for the earth and for our fellow human beings with our hands.
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting that the indigenous peoples of all the cultures in the world, every place, North America, South America, around the world, they had an understanding of the balance of nature. What can we learn from indigenous peoples?
I've thought about that a lot. And I would say that their sense of being part of nature rather than above nature is actually pretty central to their worldview. You know, human beings are one of the animals in the forest, and you need to get along with the other animals if you're going to be okay. And so that idea of connection, they have the Lakota have a phrase, all my relations, which means, you know, we are relations with everything. The second thing is community, relationship with each other. And what I find is that tends to take priority in their communities over having things, material things. And so whenever you're getting your needs met through, you know, love and caring and people being around you, you're having less need for things to help try to make you happy. And those things, the less we use of those, the better off the earth is.
The spiritual organization that I am affiliated with recently had a sharing in which we talked about the South African term Ubuntu. And the extended definition is, I am because we are. That it's truly the community, that we're not the individual. We are the community.
I'm not familiar with that phrase, but I see that it kind of confirms what I was just saying.
Absolutely. In that environment, when a child is born in a village, the elder raises the child in the air and says, whose child is this? And the entire community responds, our child. Everyone takes responsibility for each other.
Right, right. And that is one of the aspects of Native American culture, is the idea that the whole community raises that child.
You and your wife strive to walk your talk by eliminating, where and when possible, those items in life that take a toll on the environment, including refrigerators and cars. Now, you've shared recently that the pandemic necessitated returning to having these items, albeit temporarily. How would you suggest that a culture that has become dependent on items such as these approach this?
Well, how does one get religion? It happens not because somebody gives you a lecture. It usually happens because something happens in your life. And I want to pay attention to the idea that there are points in one's life where one has the opportunity to pay attention to do things differently. Some of those are predictable, like graduating from college or graduating from high school or moving to a new town or getting married or retiring. Each one of these things has an opportunity for you to do things differently. So in the case of the car, those are the predictable ones, by the way. The unpredictable ones, like, you know, becoming very ill or getting drafted or in our case, the car broke down. There are opportunities for us to really examine what our values are and kind of reset ourselves. So I was taking our van to scatter my mother's ashes back in 2007, and I was in the California desert, and it broke down. And the car repair shops at the other end of the tow basically said it wasn't worth fixing. I called my wife and I said, you know, the car broke down. I thought I was going to get a lecture or something to the idea of I shouldn't have taken an old car on that long of a trip. Instead, she said, I've been thinking maybe we can live without a car. We did that for 13 years. She didn't make me commit to it. You know, she just basically said, let's just try it for a month or two, you know, and we've made it work for a month or two. And then, you know, and it was already practicing what we preached is that you want to reduce our carbon thing, but the adjustments we had to make at the time weren't as hard as we thought. And partly it was because our kids had moved out, so we were no longer doing the taking the kids to school thing.
And I personally had an experience like that last year in our off the sharing. I had mentioned that a year ago, March of 2020, because of the onset of COVID-19, my career of 42 years basically had to come to an end because of the necessity for me to be in contact with folks and as part of the business. And one of the perks that I had in that position was a company vehicle all those years. And I had no vehicle for the first time in 42 years. And I learned how to walk again. And I found that walking not only was beneficial to the environment, but I was starting to get more strength and stamina. My breathing improved, everything actually improved. And I learned that I could actually get along for the most part in day-to-day living without a vehicle.
We had a similar experience. We have a great public transportation system here in Portland, but just walking back and forth to catch the bus and taking those short walks instead of getting in the car, you know, to go down to the restaurant or something like that was, you know, I would assert that people without cars often don't have the weight problems that people with cars have. Now, that's not science. That's just that the exercise we get for not having a car, I think, is really good for us.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it taught me that I really didn't need, you know, you think of the car as a need. Most folks do anyway. And I really didn't need that car for 80% of the transportation that I was doing at the time.
One thing I'd comment on is I took a walk through the Midwest along the Keystone XL pipeline, and I met people that, you know, were miles away from their school and things like that. And the question came, well, we couldn't possibly do without a car. And I, you know, and I have to say, I'm not here to lecture how to live your life. I'm saying, okay, well, one, you can look at a car with better gas mileage, or nowadays we can look at a car, electric car, because there's less carbon involved. But the second is, it's not just about doing without a car. It's about finding the way you can be good to the earth, whatever your situation is. So, for instance, there, they can work with their schools to help make sure that environmental literacy is taught. They can try to elect people that are friendlier to the environment when laws are being made. So not only is it about living without a car, it's about finding what it is that's possible within your circumstance.
Absolutely. And you offer so many ways in your book, Our Environmental Handprints, but you say that we should pick five, and we'll talk about that in the next segment. I just want to touch on something else right now. I love the expression in your book where you say we should move with graceful economy. What are some of the ways we may do this?
Well, let's start with the bicycle. It's arguably the best form of transportation ever invented. It's several times as efficient as walking. It's 30 times as efficient as riding a car. So when possible, use a bicycle. Well, this is not rocket science, and this is not news. A lot of people understand that already. So we haven't embraced the bicycle as our primary commuting vehicle for all the reasons that people give. You know, I like to think that maybe it's because we just think we have the right to own a car, we being Americans. So that's where I say, okay, if you've got to have a car, then have a good car, a small, environmentally appropriate car. The electric cars are much friendlier to the environment if you have renewable generation of electricity, you know, solar panels and windmills and that sort of thing. So I'm basically saying, let's choose the best form of transportation that's right for your circumstance and right for the earth.
Absolutely. My guest is John Beamer. His book is called Our Environmental Handprints, Recover the Land, Reverse Global Warming, Reclaim the Future. John, please tell our listeners where they can get your book and find out more about you.
Well, you can get the book at any of the online booksellers. So I have a list of them on my website, johnbeamer.com. JohnBeamer.com. They aren't being sold in bookstores because the primary audience for this particular book is libraries. So You know, it's worth going online and seeing if you can find it there just by typing in the title, Our Environmental Handprints.
My guest is John Beamer. We'll be back with more of John after these words on the OM Times Radio Network.
The best of the holistic, spiritual, and conscious world. OM Times Radio. IOM FM. OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Hello, I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, host of OM Times Magazine's flagship radio show, What is Going On? My passion is sifting through information, research, and innovations from New Thought teachers, speakers, and researchers pushing back the boundaries of what we know about life, energy, metaphysics, and the universe. I love shifting perceptions about who we are, why we're here, and how quickly impossible becomes normal when we open our minds, expand our awareness, and accept that the only limits that exist are those we place upon ourselves. So if you're the kind of forward-thinking, eager investigator of what lies beyond the current reality that most perceive, why not make a date to come play with me in the field of possibilities at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. Eastern Time every Thursday, and together we can discover what's really going on.
Vox Novus, the new voice. Vox Novus, the new dimension. Vox Novus, thought and movement leaders who will share from their experience and offer tools to help us navigate our rapidly changing world. My name is Victor Furman. Join me every Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern on OM Times Radio for Vox Novus, the new voice.
Hey, Dad, your prescription will be ready in just a minute. Hey, Dad, your laundry will be ready in just a minute. Dad? Your lunch will be ready in just a minute.
Hey, honey, why don't you take a minute?
When you help care for a loved one, you give them as much time as you can, making sure they're safe and comfortable. But it's just as important that you take some time for yourself. At AARP, we can help with information and useful tips on how you can maintain a healthy life balance, care for your own physical and mental well-being, and manage the challenges of caring for a loved one. Because the better care you take of yourself, the better care you can provide for your loved one.
Thanks, Dad.
Thank you. You're there for them. We're here for you. Find free care guides to support you and your loved one at aarp.org/caregiving. That's aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Hi, I'm Lindsay Sterling, and I know what it's like to struggle with mental health issues. If you have a friend that's going through a tough time, now's the perfect moment to reach out. Learn how to start the conversation at seizetheawkward.org.
Brought to you by the Ad Council, the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, and the Jed Foundation.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this week, John Beamer. He's the author of the book, Our Environmental Handprints, Recover the Land, Reverse Global Warming, Reclaim the Future. John, in the last segment, we were talking about your concept of graceful economy. That word graceful has a greater meaning here, doesn't it?
Yes. A while back, I was asking myself, well, you know, I've been in sustainability for 40 odd years. Well, back then, I guess it was 30 odd years. And it's kind of like, okay, so what do I do with this? And the insight came to me, bring spirit to sustainability. And what came to me was that there are some words in the English language that actually have spirit imbued within them. And graceful is one of them. You know, grace is the idea that there's something beyond pretty, something beyond nice. that's deep. It's spiritual. And there are other words like that too, elegant. And even the word like family, you know, it describes a group of people, but if you think about it, it describes an interaction of people and a way that we get our needs met and all sorts of deep things that are pretty close to spiritual. So I've been trying to, put those kinds of ways of looking at things into my language and into my ways of looking at sustainability.
Beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. I think that's really important. Yeah, if we look at spirit, no matter what our respective faith or no faith, but whatever our respective belief systems are, the concept of bringing that spiritual nature into everything that we do actually changes everything that we do when we think of it that way. So thank you for sharing that. Mm-hmm. In my neighborhood here in Queens, New York, we've witnessed in the last 5 or 6 years the installation of solar panels on the roofs of homes, and much of this has been partially subsidized by tax abatements, low interest financing, and cost sharing with the utility. This is a great example of partnership between the consumer, utility, and government. Is this being modeled elsewhere?
Yes. I think the different ways that it manifests itself are unique to the area. The one that I'm fascinated with here in Oregon is we have what's called community solar. And in the case of community solar, what you can do is you can, you know, buy into a solar system that is built somewhere outside of your house, outside of your neighborhood, maybe an array in a field, nearby that has plenty of sun. You don't have to worry about trees, and you pay your fair share and you get your return in terms of the solar energy and that sort of thing without having to be limited to the architecture of your house.
And that's a big point, because not everyone's homes have a roof that's configured to get maximum sunlight.
Right, right. I don't know how many states are doing that, but I think it's a really good idea wherever you can start putting that into the ordinances. And by the way, this idea of handprints, of creating, change, creating some of these ordinances that allow that kind of thing is part of how we create handprints.
Absolutely. You know,
plastic bag bans is a handprint.
Absolutely. I was going to share that here in New York, over the last several years, it has now become part of the law in New York City with the Department of Sanitation that every citizen recycle. And the recycling involves plastics and metals, paper goods, obviously, and also in the last couple of years, suspended during the COVID because of reasons that become obvious, but food scrap, recycling food scrap. And the majority of folks have taken it to heart, and it's a beautiful thing. And you see the multicolored receptacles on the sidewalk during collection day, and one color for the plastics and metals, one color for the paper, et cetera. And I'm happy to say that at least in my neighborhood here, everyone is complying, and it's a wonderful thing.
That whole recycling was actually an outcome of some of the concerns we had about landfills and things like that. We're going back to the 1950s, 60s, 70s, somewhere in there, where landfills were filling up and toxic waste were going in places that were very harmful. That whole recycling movement grew out of that. That's an environmental justice kind of thing too. Mm-hmm. So my sense is there's a kind of arc of things. The recycling is like one movement from reducing waste. And then we have the next one that we're trying to do here, which is, reusing things like thrift stores and that sort of thing, where you can actually buy clothing that has been owned by somebody else, and you can think of it as used clothing, or you can think of it as something that's actually, really neat and environmentally appropriate.
Absolutely. With reference to communities forming cooperatives, we talked about the energy cooperative. What other cooperatives can communities engage in?
The cooperatives, What are the cooperatives in our area?
Well, yes. What are some of the things, in addition to electricity, what are some of the other energy cooperatives that people can engage in?
Well, cooperatives basically is a form of business that doesn't involve ownership by some set of stockholders outside of their field. Okay. So we have our food cooperative. We're, you know, basically they reflect the values of their members. And so in our particular case, the People's Food Co-op has no meat, as they don't sell meat. It's just, if you want to get meat, you have to go somewhere else. They have a farmer's market. They, you know, have all the organic foods that you can find elsewhere, plus some that you wouldn't find. They offer bulk foods. So food cooperatives are an important thing. Banks, let's see, we have banks and then we have credit unions. Credit unions are basically a kind of cooperative where we basically say it's for the benefit of the people in the area. And if we can kind of recycle our money within our area rather than sending it off to, you know, bank accounts far away, we're all better off.
Absolutely. You have many, many suggestions, as I mentioned earlier in your book, for readers to become environmentally conscious and active, but rather than overwhelm them, you say pick five. Why five?
Back when I came up with the handprint idea, somebody said, "So, that's nice. What are you going to do with it?" And I came up with the idea of doing a handprint workshop where I would ask people to think of five things, one for each finger, and, you know, actually draw a picture of their hand on a piece of paper, you know, kind of trace around it, and then pick five things that you want to do looking forward that you can, you know, have some intention around doing, and then share those five things with the friend. And all that amounts to is just being conscious of what you want to do. So for some people, it might be, I want to start recycling. And other people, it might be, I want to go back to school and get into some environmentally, you know, friendly profession. So it can be small things. It can be large things. It can be volunteering. There's just a whole range of things, like that whole 178 ideas in the book speaks to. But my sense is really you kind of have to start with what it is that you're already in thinking about, whatever you're exposed to, and then get down the road 5-6 months and think, okay, how many of those have I done? Let's say I've done three of them. Well, maybe that means that one of them just wasn't really meant for me to do, and another one of those I really need to bear down on because I really want to do it. So we're narrowing down the whole spectrum of possibilities to what's right for me. And also, if you talk about it to somebody else, you sort of make it more real and maybe a little bit like you're going to hold yourself to it a little bit more seriously, even though the person you tell about it probably will forget about them.
So we talked about this a little bit before. Let's look at some of the things that readers can do as their five. So let's start with diet. You had talked about food cooperatives. How may modifying our diets be environmentally friendly?
Well, meat, beef is probably one of the worst things for the environment because there's a whole industry out there that releases a whole lot of carbon into the atmosphere. I'm talking about that in addition to whatever health kinds of concerns we have and also in addition to whatever animal cruelty concerns we have. So eliminating beef is a starting point. And then you can go down the spectrum, like chicken uses about a quarter or releases about a quarter of the amount of carbon into the atmosphere. Then going vegetarian or going to vegetables just lowers us down even more. So eliminating meat is a good thing. And by the way, if you want to do without a refrigerator, meat spoilage is basically your basic problem with needing a refrigerator. So if you can eliminate that from your diet, that's good. By the way, I'm not a vegetarian. I occasionally have meat at a restaurant, but frankly, I've gotten so used to eating vegetarian that it's just my norm. Let's see. And regenerative foods are particularly good. These are foods that that you don't have to plow the ground to to grow. And so any fruits or nuts, you know, where the tree keeps on giving year after year, even though you harvest every year, is good for the environment, because that plowing of the ground disturbs all the little organisms that soak up the carbon from the atmosphere.
Believe it or not, here in Queens, New York, we have the benefit of a neighbor who has a mulberry tree in their backyard, which is adjacent to our backyard, and half the tree grows over on our side, and they welcome us to take our pick of the mulberries every season. We just had our mulberry season, and they're delicious, and they're wonderful, so yes, I know exactly what you're talking about.
We have a mulberry tree here, too. And
whatever the squirrels and birds don't get, we can have. So it's really a nice relationship that we have with them. Right. You also say we can make our homes eco-friendly, and when contemplating a move, choose an eco-friendly home. What should we do and look for in eco-friendly homes?
Well, the first thing, okay, the first thing is the size of your house. The wall area determines to some extent how much energy gets lost outside that wall. So a small house is better for the environment. And what I was going to say also is living in an apartment where you have common walls with your neighbors is even better. Now, maybe you don't want to live in an apartment. Well, let's look at it the other way. Maybe you have to live in an apartment. And I just want to point out that people in New York City use less energy per capita than any state in the nation. And that's partly because a lot of them live in apartments. And also because a lot of them live without cars. So then we can go to things like, well, your light bulbs, let's make sure there's LED light bulbs. And if you want to get a little proactive, let's make sure that gas water heater that's got a big tank that loses a lot of energy out of its side, let's change that out with a demand water heater, a tankless water heater that only uses electricity or uses, well, energy when you actually turn on the water. They cost a little bit, but they occupy less space, and they're better for the environment. And sometimes there's a tax credit or something like that that will help you purchase them.
Yes, our local utility company actually, with LED light bulbs, passes them on at virtual cost for those who are willing to make the investment in them. And they're not that expensive at virtual cost. And over the last couple of years, I think virtually every one of my neighbors has switched over to LED light bulbs, and it's a wonderful thing.
I would say there's stages too. You can, first of all, you can just change out some of the light bulbs easily. And just do that, you know, and that may take care of, you know, like 60-80% of your light bulbs. And then you'll have these specialty light bulbs like dimming light bulbs or floodlights through your patios or whatever else, you know. And you may have to go to a little effort and find the electrical supply store that provides those. So don't let not being able to do all of them stop you from doing some of them. Same thing with, the eating, you know, let's improve our diets. You don't have to become, go to a monastery just to be better at things.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, it's funny. You talked about used clothing and people buying used clothing and sustainability with used clothing. Are there other fashion conscious, eco-friendly ideas?
Fashion conscious, eco-friendly ideas?
In other words, clothing that's made through sustainability.
I think the fashion consciousness is in the mind. It's sort of like if you think in terms of used as beautiful, if I'm wearing my values, if I'm demonstrating what's possible, if I'm visualizing that this piece of clothing that I'm buying here instantly eliminates it, it going into the landfill. To me, the beauty is in the doing. And then there are companies that actually have stylish clothing and that sort of thing. You can look them up online, and I mention them in the book. But I think the beauty is in the heart to start with.
Absolutely. I actually have a t-shirt that my wife gave me. I'm a fixer. Anything that breaks, I fix. And that's one of my contributions to
sustainability.
Thank you. And my wife bought me a t-shirt that says basically, if Victor can't fix it, we're all screwed. So philosophy that we live by and I encourage. My guest is John Beamer. His book is called Our Environmental Handprints, Recover the Land, Reverse Global Warming, Reclaim the Future. We'll be back with more of John after these words on the Om Times Radio Network.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that we can give our daughters everything they need to grow and learn. But not every child can focus on classes and play dates.
Nearly 13 million kids in the U.S. face hunger. That's 1 in 6. School lunch might be their only meal each day. And it's heartbreaking to imagine any child going to bed hungry. We're dreaming of a perfect day when kids can smile, play, and just be kids without worrying about where their next meal will come from. Feeding America is working to make that perfect day a reality.
Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste. That food is given to families and children in need. Being a kid should be about doing things that make an ordinary day extraordinary. Learning to play an instrument, building a sandcastle, hosting tea parties. Hunger should never be an obstacle to growing up.
You can help end childhood hunger in your community by visiting feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Humanity Healing International is a small nonprofit with a big dream. Since 2007, HHI has been working tirelessly to bring help to communities with little or no hope. Our projects are not broad mandates, nor are they overnight solutions, but they bring the reassurance that no one is alone and that someone cares. To learn more, please visit humanityhealing.org. Humanity Healing is where your heart is.
So I'm a cat, and I just moved in with this new human, and she's got this little toy she's always playing with, all day long. Tap, 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 bloop, bloop. She can't put it down. There it is. Oh, and get this. She even talks to it. Last week, she asked it for Chinese, and guess what? Egg rolls showed up, like magic. Humans have cool toys.
A person is the best thing to happen to a shelter pet. Be that person. Adopt. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this week is John Beamer, and his book is called Our Environmental Handprints, Recover the Land, Reverse Global Warming, Reclaim the Future. John, in the last segment, we were talking about this concept of repairing things and reusing things, and you have this concept in your book that you talk about called Repair Cafe. What's that about?
Yeah. A woman in Holland, I think it was, came up with this idea that we would have people that like to repair things and have some ability to do that sit on one side of the table, and people that have needs come to them and just wait for them to be repaired. And that idea has caught fire around the world. There's like 1,000 different repair cafe kind of communities within around the world. Here in Portland, I think there's probably 3 different ones. And what they do is they hold repair cafes on a Saturday about once every 3, 4, or 5 months. And it's just neat. I had a scooter that was stuck in a certain place that I thought I had to throw it away. It was, you know, for my grandson. And I took it in there, and there was a guy that works on bicycles, and he just twisted it and flexed it in a certain way, and it came undone, and it was completely back in shape within 5 minutes. You know, his skill working with bicycles was just instantly available for me. Another time I had a robe that had a hole in it that I liked a lot, and some woman put a patch in it. And, you know, that robe has served me for another 3 or 4 years. It's just wonderful, because some of these people just, you know, they love to do this kind of thing. So it's tinkering, and they have these skills. Many of them are retired. It's win-win.
Absolutely. And that really is a key to sustainability on a grand scale. One of my pet peeves is when takeout food establishments toss in plastic forks and knives and spoons. I personally request that they don't do that, and I use my own flatware at home. What are some of the ways that environmentally minded people can do the same with the restaurants and businesses they deal with?
Well, I'm particularly... Let's start with the fact that you can carry a spoon with you. You know, my wife equipped me with a spork, which is a fork on one end and a spoon on the other end. Mm-hmm. And there are very nice ones that aren't a piece of junk, and they can last for years, and all you have to do is wash them. So if you have one of those with you, and you have maybe a bowl with you, you have all sorts of options whenever you need something to eat. So I'm thinking in terms of the fast food places. I just basically say, don't give me a spoon. I've got my own. And they kind of look at me a little bit askance, and they say, okay. And that's the end of that conversation. Now, I haven't got into the practice of trying to lecture my restaurants as to how to do their business. And they usually have reusable utensils, so they're not bothering me in quite the sense that this plastic wears. But I do have a particular irritation, if you will, and that is weddings. Weddings so often use plastic spoons, forks, and paper plates, and maybe plastic plates, and then throw them away. The amount of waste that goes into a wedding is just amazing. And what better place for a couple to demonstrate their values than when they get married? What better time to share with your community, this is what we want to represent? And of course, weddings is just one occasion. You have potlucks and that sort of thing. So I am an advocate of sort of changing the way potlucks and weddings are done. And if you really want an elegant wedding, you can rent all those things from places that provide the cutlery and such. So please take advantage of the opportunities. These are, by the way, ceremonies. People tend to learn things at ceremonies better than they do in ordinary life. So, people will remember what happened at that particular occasion.
Ritual education. Absolutely. I agree with you 100%. You consult with businesses in making changes to their practices and operations to make them more environmentally conscious and responsible. Please share some of your success stories with us and how you changed their culture.
Consulting I do is organizational development consulting, which is basically applying systems thinking to an organization. So I'm constantly looking for ways to tweak whatever system they have to make it operate better. So the typical things would be, establish your goals, find out what your strengths are, build on those strengths. Now, where I like to specialize is with organizations that already have an environmental mission. So basically, I can help them be more successful at doing what they do. So for instance, one organization is environmental education. So they go in there and and provide supplemental education to the curriculum. And I help them be more successful. Another organization, let's see.
I know I heard an interview that you did with your chiropractor friend where you changed him from a chemical x-ray system to a digital x-ray system.
Exactly. And you know something? I didn't tell him to do that. I came to him with my values of, you know, use less, be less toxic and that sort of thing. So his going from basically chemical x-ray kind of processes to digital x-ray processes was entirely his own. And I think that's part of what I do is I go into an organization with my values, with my book, with my all that things, but I'm there to serve them, to help them do what they need to do. And frankly, your listeners of your show, you know, I'm here to help your listeners figure out how to do better at what they already want to do. That's really my specialty. You know, I think of myself as a catalyst. You know, there's this enzyme in a plant called Rubisco. That's a short for an scientific name that takes carbon dioxide and breaks it into carbon and oxygen, and it gives that carbon to the plant. And then it lets the oxygen go. That carbon is all, you know, does all sorts of things within the plant, you know, makes sugars and food and that sort of thing. So if I can help people figure out how to take that that information or that just is flowing around us all the time and say, let's do something with this. Let's make the world a better place. And it's not accidental. People actually have to put a little of their own energy into this and their own insight and their own background.
We live in a society where reward seems to be the motive for positive behavior. For those who need positive reinforcement, what are some of the ways this can be win-win for the doer and the environment?
Well, I have to go to the value of caring. So if we care about something, then it being better off is a good thing for us. And then we can take that one step further and we can say, if we deal with global warming, then we're all better off. There are various entrepreneurial things. Maybe think in terms of investments. We can invest in, like, volunteer to clean up the park, the local river and that sort of thing. And you know, that makes it a better environment for us. There's entrepreneurial kinds of things. There's bicycle delivery services. People that can go around and change light bulbs for elderly people. People that, take the leftover food from farmers markets and take them to people that need it. Anytime you do something worthwhile, you're going to feel good about it. And, you know, ultimately, you know, feeling good about something is a pretty big motivator.
You also advocate donations to environmentally active organizations. How do we find those that we resonate with?
Well, buy my book. I've got...
Okay, you got
I think that. I've got 208 of them in there, and you could go down the index.
There you go. There you go. That's wonderful.
I have a few favorites, you know, that are kind of neat. You know, Nature Conservancy basically buys land that has endangered species on it. Pachamama Alliance helps the indigenous people of South America take responsibility for their own lands so that the governments aren't constantly trying to drill it for oil and mine it for minerals. So yes, there are worthwhile organizations all over everywhere. But I would say start with the topic that's most interesting to you.
And the loaded question, how may we work with our elected officials to act upon environmentally responsible legislation?
I just heard a lecture the other day. So actually visiting your officials is probably one of the best things you can do. Bring your values to your official and to their staff people and to the people who organize things. So basically, try to leverage whatever you're doing with whatever they're doing, because we all have limited powers and limited reach. And you're basically, if you can help the congressperson or the state legislator, the city council person be more successful at what they're doing, that's great. Now, if they're not particularly open to this kind of thing, then we're talking about finding a replacement for them. So you can support the replacements, or you can run for office yourself.
Absolutely. The wisdom of John Beamer, his book, Our Environmental Handprints, Recover the Land, Reverse Global Warming, Reclaim the Future. John, one more time, please tell our listeners where they can get your book and find out more about you.
Yes, you can get it online at any of the online booksellers, and you can go to my website, johnbeamer.com. That's J-O-N-B as in boy, I-E-M-E-R.com. And I have those online booksellers on my website.
John, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your wisdom, your dedication, and the spirit of what you're trying to achieve and what this world really needs. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And thank you for joining us on Destination Unlimited. I'm Victor, the Voice Furman. Have a wonderful week.